Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Episode 78 of The Bowery Boys, The Great Fire of 1835.
Hey, it's The Bowery Boys.
Hey.
The Bowery Boys is brought to you by Eurocheapo.com. Eurocheapo editors personally visit and review the best budget hotels in Europe, now with hotels in New York City, on the web at Eurocheapo.com.
Hello there, welcome to the Bowery Boys. My name is Greg Young.
And I'm Tom Myers.
This week's episode is, believe it or not, I think one of the most important events in New York City history. I think it's...
Wow.
It's very monumental. It's a dramatic story, as you'll see.
Well, it greatly transformed the young city. It was a traumatic event that actually led to the rebuilding and modernization of the town.
But the actual events of it are very... They're heart-stopping, they're thrilling, they're a little bit depressing.
We are talking about the fire of 1835, which is often referred to as the Great Fire.
Yes, now many great cities, of course, have their own great fires. London, San Francisco, and of course, Chicago. And New York has actually had two or three, but this is really the biggest one, and I guess you could say the last truly great fire.
So we'll take you there, not too close to the flames, but close enough to see where it happened, what streets are still there today that were completely rebuilt.
It is true, Tom. There's one street in particular, which we'll tell you all about the end of this podcast, where you can literally see the sort of effects of the Great Fire immediately on the actual shape of the street.
So put on your mittens and bundle up, because we're going to step outside into that icy night of the Great Fire of 1835.
The locations that we're going to be talking about today are all in the financial district, sort of like Wall Street on the east side, around the shore of the East River and sort of going in towards around Broad Street.
Just almost up to Broadway. And we should actually point out, Greg, that as we're recording this podcast, and notably, we're recording in the morning, which we hardly ever do, so you get to hear us caffeinated and without the whole day's experience trudging us down.
That's true, yes. Well rested.
And there is a sound of a helicopter going by overhead, several helicopters. What's going on with that, Greg?
Well, actually, just north of the area in which we're going to be talking about today, the disgraced financier, Bernie Madoff, is being taken to court today. So, and since we're kind of nearby that, there are literally like a dozen helicopters like zooming through the sky. So if there's any kind of like, if it sounds like a vacuum cleaner in the background, no, we're not being uncourteous.
Right, it's just Channel 4 News going by overhead with a live cam shot. But Bernie is actually heading down nearly to the fire district.
Bernie to the burning district.
Yes.
Of
before the burning made off with half of Manhattan.
So let me back up here, Tom, and give you a little brief recap of sort of the fire history of the island of Manhattan up until 1835, get you up to that point. Now, New York, as in all pre-industrial cities are, let's just say they're very flammable.
Exactly how are they flammable?
Well, I mean, you're talking about up until this time, a city of mostly wooden structures that are all built closely together.
Mm-hmm.
people have torches and lanterns. You also don't have, like, proper fire safety codes at this time and those types of precautions.
And tiny little streets that have sort of grown with the city from its earliest days. So not easy to get through with fire carts and such.
Fire spreads very easily in a city like New York. I mean, fire's been with New York almost since the beginning. As a matter of fact, the first documented fire was in 1628. New York's barely just a few years old at that time, so...
We'll have to really look that one up for episode 720.
The first fire of New York City. You know, by 1648, the town of New Amsterdam was already passing these city ordinances for fire prevention. Primarily, believe it or not, a lot of these fires were because people had wooden chimneys that they weren't cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
So there was the first fire ordinance was that everyone needed to, by law, had to clean their chimneys between the fort and the fresh water. So everyone basically between Fort Amsterdam, you know, at the foot of the island, up to the, quote, fresh water, up to Collect Pond. So anything in between there was under this law to clean the chimneys. You know, when there was a fire, I mean, what did they have to fight it with? They had these crude leather fire buckets, very basic, rudimentary equipment, no real hoses to speak of. But one benefit that New York's always had is it's surrounded by water, of course.
The rivers would certainly come in handy, you know, if a fire would break out, say, when it's not freezing outside and you have access to the water.
And there's also wells and cisterns that would also be used for this. Now, around 1657 is when the sort of first, what you could call, not really a fire department, but people who are actually out looking for fires, they actually called these men the Rattle Watch, because they would walk the streets from dusk until dawn. There was sort of like a police/fire department, and they called them the Rattle Watch, believe it or not, because they actually had these large rattles that they would wear on the side. And when something happened, when there was like a fire, they would just shake these rattles. And so everyone would just jump up and react to what was happening.
Wow.
They also called these men prowlers because they also tended to sometimes get up to mischief on top of watching their own city.
Were they only allowed to rattle their sticks if they spotted a fire? Or any kind of trouble?
No, all sorts of trouble, you know, like
a marauding
group of pigs or something, I don't know. By the way, another ordinance at this time had that each citizen of the town of New Amsterdam, before they went to bed, had to put 3 buckets of water out on their porch, just in case a fire happened, so they could run and get these buckets of water.
Wow. Yeah.
So with the British takeover, they still hadn't necessarily improved the methods of fighting fire. However, I will say in 1731 that the British did get their very first hand fire engine. Have you seen these old antique fire engines with a little pump on them? Yes. Interestingly, back then, it was actually the mayor and the aldermen of the city who were actually in charge of storing these. Like, there wasn't really a fire department. So it was up to the mayor and himself to kind of store these things. So 5 years later, New York actually got its very first fire station, believe it or not, which is on the very street and block as the New York Stock Exchange. Now, up during British occupation, there were two major fires that affected New York City. The first one was in 1741. We call this the Great Conspiracy of 1741. There were a series of fires that were purposefully set, including one that was at Fort George, which was the former Fort Amsterdam when the British took over. They called it Fort George. A fire was set there, and many other homes and businesses were destroyed, but they were purposefully set. This was a bit of arson. So, through whispers and rumors, everyone thought that it was some kind of a slave revolt, a plot between slaves and some poor whites. So, a massive witch hunt went on at this time. There were several people who were killed. 2 were burned at the stake because of this, because they thought it was this... They had to squash this awful plot, which of course didn't really happen. It was all a bunch of hysteria. A very fascinating story, which we'll have to cover in a future podcast. That was the first major fire. Then, of course, we've covered the second one, Tom, if you remember, which happened on September 21st and 22nd in 1776. Please see our podcast on the British invasion for more information, but this was the fire...
Our podcasts. It's a two-parter.
That's correct. This happened a little bit after the Continental Army fled Manhattan when the British came in and took it over. The fire started at a tavern called the Fighting Cock's Tavern on Whitehall Street. It destroyed between 400 and 500 buildings, or basically one quarter of the entire city. This was not started by the Continental Army. You know, this was a really horrible fire because, of course, not only was a quarter of the city destroyed, but it was like the city was filled with people at this time, and a lot of the influx of war refugees and all of these soldiers.
Right.
The fire was extinguished by the British Navy. But the thing to remember about this particular fire, about what we're about to talk about, this fire happened on kind of a nice fall day. It wasn't
the 1776.
Fire of 1776 in September. It was a nice fall day. You know, there were still crude firefighting methods at this time, but you had hundreds of men in the city, and they were all soldiers. They were all prepared to take
ready
care
to
of
fight
this.
A fire.
So they were able to stop it before it got worse. I mean, it got really terrible. The original Trinity Church was burnt down. Lots of other things were burnt down. I'm not saying this was not a bad fire, but compared to what we're about to talk about, it could have been worse. So, Tom, get us up to speed then of what life is like in 1835.
Well, so the city of New York was at this point about a quarter of a million people.
Mm-hmm.
We have to remember that the Erie Canal had come into the picture, into the city, and had been a boom to the city's economy.
It was only like 10 years old at this time, right? So they were really reaping the benefits now, the
right.
profits.
And it meant that all of these exporters from the city, all these manufacturers, really benefited from being able to ship to the rest of the country. So the city was filled with factories and with merchants of all kinds. So much trade was flourishing, and of course the stock exchange, or the merchants exchange, as it was called then. However, there was also a serious water shortage because Collect Pond had been covered over, three decades
it
before
had been drained,
that?
Right.
Right, drained, and then of course on top of it had been built all of these apartment buildings or residences that started to sink into the land because it was never properly drained, and rich people were fleeing that neighborhood, and of course taking their place were the newly arrived, mostly Irish immigrants who were fleeing their own potato famine. So we had this sort of dynamic happening. People were actually selling water in the street. Men would go around with carts and sell buckets of it in the street. Except this particular December that we're talking about in 1835, it was so cold that the week of the fire, people couldn't even walk around selling water. The temperatures were freezing. Some reports 2 days before the fire that the temperature had actually fallen to 17 degrees below zero, which seems really incredible.
It was a cold winter here in New York this year, but I have never quite experienced that.
Just 3 years before, in the summer of 1832, the young city of New York had experienced a terrible cholera breakout. It left the city empty. I mean, half the city fled that summer. Other people couldn't even get out of the city. The poorest people were stuck in Five Points, couldn't really take off. Well, 4,000 people died during the June to October 1832 cholera epidemic, and that really did a number also on the city's police and fire force. But there still were firemen. However, 2 days before the fire of 1835, on December 14th, there was another fire, and it had depleted resources that were already pretty feeble.
Now, we should mention that when you say fire department, it's not exactly what we would consider fire department today.
Really, I should have said firefighters.
Because there was mostly a volunteer organization,
right.
Correct?
Right.
And they weren't getting paid.
Right.
It was very disorganized. It was very localized.
Well, weren't there competing groups?
Yes, and that would actually continue to be a little bit of a problem even a little bit after the story. It wasn't organized in the way that it seems logical that ours is organized today, if that makes any sense.
The New York Times calls BritBox the best of British telly. Stream acclaimed original series, including Payback, starring Peter Mullen, Stonehouse, starring Matthew McFadyen, and Archie, the man who became Cary Grant, starring Jason Isaacs. Plus, discover powerful new series like The Three Little Birds and the return of BAFTA-winning drama, Time, starring Bella Ramsey, Tamara Lawrence, and Jodie Whittaker. Stream the best of British TV, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
So it's December 16th, and it's 9 p.m. at night, and it is freezing in the city. It's very dark. And
most people have gone to sleep.
We're in the area of the city that is a little bit below Wall Street. in this sort of eastern area of what we call the financial district today. So basically like Wall Street, with Broad Street sort of being the western edge of the area we're talking about. And then, of course, like South Street, or the edge of the water, would be the eastern part of what the area we're talking about.
And this area was mostly filled with trading houses, with factories and warehouses, and merchants, and some residences.
Some, but a lot of these merchants who would normally have lived above their shops, for instance, you know, this is now an era where they're able to like have a house that's separate from their own shops.
Right.
There is a watchman, walking through the streets, and his name is William Hayes, and you know, he's probably got a cloak on. It's really cold. He's got a lantern, just walking these dark city streets, and you know, his job is to sort of patrol. You can probably see his breath because it's so cold. He probably wants to go in, smoke his pipe, and you know, maybe have a mug of beer. When he gets to the corner of Pearl Street and Exchange Street, which is no longer there, it's today's Beaver Street. Mm-hmm. When he gets to this intersection, precisely at a building at 25 Merchant Street, he notices that a building is on fire. It's actually this building for a dry goods store called Comstock and Andrews. It's a 5-story building, and one of the upper floors is on fire. Apparently what happened is there was a broken gas line that had burst sometime during the early evening. It had ignited some coals that were on a stove. So this fire started raging. He noticed it. He ran and he got some help. By the time he got back, unfortunately, this little fire that had just been in one building was spreading rapidly. This is the dry goods district of Manhattan. So it's, you know, it's close to the piers. This is where things kind of like got right off the boat. And you can sell the merchandise right there in these stores. Within a few minutes, the fire starts raging. Within 30 minutes of finding this fire, it had already spread to 50 buildings. It was quickly moving because the biggest enemy that night wasn't just the fire, it was the fact that it was really windy. And this wind was carrying the fire, just almost as you could just see it, like jumping from
the
building
embers.
To building. And there was just nothing you could do because it was on some of these upper floors.
Mm. And the buildings were filled with fabrics and
the worst possible things you can imagine that are just going to be flammable and just explode into flames the moment that one of these embers lands upon it. By 10 p.m., 1 hour after the fire was first discovered, 40 stores were totally blazing. And so volunteer firemen were getting their stuff together to like fight this blaze. What they're dealing with, I can't underscore this, how horrible this night was. It was a winter hell. You had all this winds and the freezing. It prevented the firefighters from really doing their jobs.
Well, because they would rush over to the East River, which of course they're right next to. But only a part of it was not frozen. There was just a bit of a channel that hadn't completely frozen over.
And then, yeah.
So how were they supposed to get water?
Well, they drilled holes into the ice, which is just unbelievable, just to get to like the water that wasn't frozen. Mm. You know, they'd stick the water down and they'd fill their engines. And so when they actually did get water, though, the problem is, you throw it onto the fire, but it's so windy that the water blew back into the firefighters, and it was just...
And it would actually freeze on their bodies, and so there were firemen who were actually covered in ice.
And that's when the water was even able to be delivered, because sometimes the water would freeze in the hoses and in the buckets by the time it got there.
Right, and the firemen were actually sort of stomping up and down on their hoses, not only to keep their feet from freezing, but also to try to get the water to break it up so that it could trickle out of those hoses.
I mean, at certain points, they just had to stand there and they would pour brandy in their boots just to sort of keep themselves warm, knowing that we can't fight this. And the sounds you must have heard, like the crackling of flames, people shouting, but this like brisk wind, the sound of buildings collapsing. If you were a business owner and your store was down here, what were you doing at this time?
Well, a lot of people were actually racing down. You know, the calls went out because all over the city, the bells were ringing. The fire
all the bells, everybody. Even the prison bells, city hall bells, like everything was just... Everyone was on high alert.
And people were racing down to their warehouses and to their stores to pull out the most valuable merchandise and put it in some kind of a safe haven.
Well, they were smashing open their windows and literally just tossing this merchandise into the street just to pick up. The problem with this, though, Tom, which is making the problem worse. And I'll tell you why. Because, you know, as you said, a lot of this was like papers and twine and cloth of all different kinds. Some of this caught on fire, but because it's so small and transportable, it got caught up by the wind. Some of these, like little flaming bombs almost, got caught up by the wind, would land in boats on the East River. Some of it got as far away as Brooklyn, and some of the rooftops on Brooklyn homes even caught on fire from this.
The fire grew so strong, in fact, that it was visible to the north in New Haven and as far away south as Philadelphia.
And this is by midnight by this time. So the fire just started 3 hours earlier. Now at midnight, people are seeing it from Poughkeepsie. They're seeing it from Philadelphia. So naturally, like, not only are the New York firefighters embattled here, but they're coming from all over the place now. There was even a team from Philadelphia.
By midnight, the burning area actually encompassed 17 blocks. So it was growing fast. It seemed like everybody in the city was out to help. Well, at first, it seemed like everybody in the city was out to help because private citizens were coming out with buckets and pails and tubs of water, you know, hoping to do something. There were more than 75 fire wagons and hose carts that were trudging their way through the snowy streets to get to the scene.
By you saying that all of humanity here was united in one cause to prevent this fire from spreading?
But not exactly, but we'll get to the looters in a second.
Okay.
But let's just think about the people, again, who owned merchandise and they were watching their businesses burn to the ground. They were grabbing their silks, their satins, even their champagne, Greg, and heading over initially to Hanover Square, which was thought to be, you know, a safe spot. They were packing a warehouse there full of goods, but soon flames actually jumped over buildings and spread to that warehouse too.
Oops.
Consuming everything in the building. So, you know, other merchants took their goods and packed it into the Merchants Exchange, stock exchange.
Right. This is one of the bigger buildings in Manhattan at this time.
And
right.
You know, it was a new structure in 1835, thought to be fireproof. Well, at 2 a.m., sailors from the Navy Yard were actually there trying to rescue bits of the Merchant Exchange. They wanted to take an Alexander Hamilton statue.
Oh, right. There was it was in the center, if I recall,
in the rotunda.
Yes.
And they were trying to move it to safety because the Merchant Exchange had also caught on fire at that point. And somebody screamed as they were trying to handle the pedestal. And they had to race out of there. And the whole place just went up in flames and collapsed. They were not injured because they got out just in the nick of time. It appeared that nothing was safe. You know, others, in fact, had taken their merchandise over to the Dutch Reformed Church on Garden Street.
And
an hour later, 3 a.m., the fire had started in the church as well. As soon as the edifice of the church actually started to flame up, people started moving their merchandise out. In the midst of this, imagine the smoky, dark, flaming interior. Legend has it that somebody crept up to the pipe organ and started playing a funeral dirge in the midst of all of this chaos.
How creepy.
Yes, and somehow appropriate. Then the church went up in flames as well. That was at about 3.
Okay, so people are fighting this blaze, but it doesn't sound like a lot of good is being done so far. So some of this merchandise was destroyed, some of it was saved.
Well, and they kept moving it in and out of these different buildings, you know, and so you can imagine the streets were then just strewn with all kinds of fabulous, fancy goods.
And, you know, keep in mind, it's icy and snowy, and people are trying to move this so that their stuff isn't destroyed.
And keep in mind that Five Points, the legendary neighborhood of hoodlums, was only, you know, a couple blocks away. So when the fire bells went off, it attracted a certain type who saw this as a real opportunity to, you know, get their hands on some good loot.
I have a quote, actually, from he would actually become a mayor of New York. His name is Philip Hone. He was one of New York's diarists, greatest diarists of the 19th century, of describing.
There's
the
a
city
medicine
at this
you
time.
Can take for that.
I don't think he was on it, or he might have been on it when he said this. Quote, "The miserable wretches who prowled about the ruins and became beastly drunk on the champagne and other wines and liquors with which the streets and wharves were lined seemed to exult in the misfortune."
in fact, yes, turned into a sort of festive affair. There were thousands of people, crowds, that were shoving their way through the streets. Not all of them looters, of course. People who just wanted to see what was going on. The city was on fire. So,
yeah, some people saw this as a horror show. Some people saw this as an opportunity.
Right. And all of the people were making, for the most part, life more difficult for the firemen who were trying to put out the flames in the first place just because they were crowding the streets. Now, hoodlums and criminals and their entourage came over and they were just kicking off actually a full day, about 24 hours of looting, where they grabbed an estimated 10,000 bottles of champagne, smashing them, fighting over them, popping them open, drinking, pouring in the snow, getting wildly drunk as they just raged from burning warehouse to burning warehouse, grabbing whatever they could grab, stashing fine things under their clothes and moving on.
Delirious.
Yes. Well, after 24 hours, martial law was finally declared and Marines moved in. But I mean, you can imagine during that 24 hours, it was complete mayhem. In fact, six men were actually caught trying to spread the fire outside of the burning district with torches, trying to light other buildings on fire. One of them was promptly hanged from a tree, and he stayed there hanging, dangling in the wind for 3 days before the police got around to cutting him down.
That's nightmarish. So it's 3 a.m. now.
Yes.
The fire has been raging for almost 6 hours. Another area that had actually been ravaged by the flames were some of the early kind of newspaper row, the newspaper district. A lot of the newspapers were up in flames.
Right.
Some of them escaped, but one of the newspapers that was sort of battling the flames was a paper called the New York American. The editor of this newspaper's name was Charles King. Well, I mean, understandably, he was completely freaking out. He was running around. He was observing the chaos, not just the flames themselves, but all of this madness that was going on, all the looting, but also sort of the ineffectual firefighting that was going on. Everything just looked absolutely hopeless. And he ran to the mayor. The mayor and the alderman had come down and they were doing something. And, you know, and Charles was a prominent citizen, so he could run up to the mayor.
Right.
The mayor at the time
during a fire.
The mayor at the time was named Cornelius Van Wyck Lawrence. And he ran up to Cornelius, and he actually had a radical idea. And that idea was, the only way you're going to stop the fire, and this sounds a little odd, I'm sure Cornelius was just like, what are you talking about? Blow up some of the buildings that are in the path. Like, see which direction the fire is going? Blow up the buildings that are right before there so that it has a sort of a hole that's created. So the fire can't...
A void.
So the fire can't jump over the hole and catch on to the next buildings. It's just stopping it in its path, but doing it in a very destructive manner. Mm. This was a very risky idea. I mean, this was controversial, to say the least.
Sure, but I mean, at that moment, obviously it looked like the entire city could go up in flames.
Well, they had to try something. So they sent people out to retrieve some explosives and some gunpowder, and there was huge caches of gunpowder and Red Hook. So they went to get them there. And also there was some in Governor's Island. Mm. So they went to both these places to get it. Now, keep in mind, how are they bringing it back? They have the icy waters of the East River. They had to go out and get the gunpowder, and then they had to come back with it. But then there's all this fire, and so some of this could jump into the boats and ignite some of this gunpowder. So what you had is you had some of these firemen taking off their outer garments down to their underwear in this sub-freezing temperatures, putting this clothing over the big barrels of explosives just to prevent them from catching on fire in the water. They didn't manage to bring these explosives over to Manhattan. Charles King and some of these city officials located a store that would be a perfect place for this. It was just sort of, it was situated in such a place that if they blew up this one building, and it was a dry goods store at 48 Exchange Place, if they blew up this building, the fire would conceivably stop and not jump across the street on Broad Street. Because if it moved past Broad Street, this fire actually could actually keep going west and hit Broadway. And that way, we'd almost like take over the whole length of the island.
Right.
So by 5 a.m., the fuses were ready and the explosives were set. The chief fire engineer of the city, though, he refused to do this. He's like, well, I can't blow up buildings. I don't think this is going to work. And so the mayor was like, well, I don't really want to do it. I'm not going to do it. So eventually, this kind of like got passed down the line. And so finally, this man named James Hamilton was just like, okay, you know what? Fine. I'll do it. Now, interestingly, you had mentioned that a statue of Alexander Hamilton had been destroyed at the Merchants Exchange.
Yes.
James is his son.
His son?
Alexander Hamilton's son then blew up the building.
But did he have any official elected role, or was he just...
He was an official and a prominent citizen. So, I mean, he wasn't just some random person off the street, but he also had an exalted position. There was a certain sort of symbolism to, you know, the son of a founding son of New York kind of person. So,
right.
So that's stopping the fire sort of, like, traveling too far west. Then, to stop the fire from traveling north, the fire has gotten almost up to Wall Street. It has caught a building on fire that I think you know quite well that I just mentioned earlier, the Tontine Coffee House, mm-hmm. the original home of the Stock Exchange. It started catching on fire, and this would have been deadly because this meant the fire was traveling north, because this is north where these other blazing buildings were. Luckily, however, there were firefighters on hand there, and they were able to douse the flames. They had a little bit of extra incentive. Now, I've read two different sources. One of them says it was one of the owners of the Tontine Coffee House. As we know, there's many owners. Another one says it was just simply a passerby who was like, you have to stop the blaze here. If you can stop the blaze at the Tontine Coffee House, I will donate $100 to the Volunteer Firefighting Fund. So with that little dangling incentive, sure enough, they doused the flames, and the Tontine Coffee House was damaged, but it was pretty much saved. It took another 24 hours from this time for the fire to really be controlled. I mean, the entire day of December 17th, the fire was still raging. The skies above New York were just clogged with black smoke. For the whole day, people were afraid that this fire was going to reignite in some way. But they did end up controlling it. You know, by December 18th, it was pretty much all done.
That there were still last dying flames, I think, up to 2 weeks after it started. They were still putting out little flames.
God, how terrifying. Because any of those things could have just ignited to another fire, I mean, any moment, so...
Well, the day after the fire, business, obviously, as usual, was suspended. The stock market was obviously closed because it had burned and collapsed. Thousands and thousands of people came out of their homes the next day and came down to the burn district of 17 blocks, 52 acres of Lower Manhattan to see what had happened. They were looking at South Street, Front Street, Pearl Street, Stone, Beaver, Water, Merchant, and Hanover. All of these streets, the entire south side of Wall Street from William Street to South Street, burned and charred, and looking at the remains of these warehouses and factories and their trading house, and thinking really that first day that the city could never recover from this, because this was their financial and their commercial center. There were 693 buildings that had been burned.
Well, it just must have looked impossible. I mean, how do you clear all that away and start over? Like,
right.
from that first week, I can definitely see that perspective.
Right. And with an estimated loss of $20 to $25 million in 1835 dollars, the amount that was insured, $10 million, by different fire insurance companies at the time, was just so high that there was no way that the insurance companies could repay those losses. And many of these insurance companies, or most of them, went out of business, as did many of the banks.
Well, and many of those insurance companies had buildings that were there anyway,
right,
so they
right.
couldn't insure themselves. Like, they were completely wiped off the map.
And, you know, many of the factories had to close permanently because they couldn't collect their insurance. They couldn't get money from the banks to buy new merchandise. And so there was just a very sad scene of people returning to their factories and to their shops, and they didn't know how they would move on. This actually led to another topic, which we'll have to talk about, the Panic of 1837, 2 years later. This was one of the key things that led into it.
What's amazing to me, with all this damage, all these buildings, only two people died.
Right.
Which is an extraordinary figure. This fire, there was like a much smaller fire that had happened 2 days before,
mm-hmm.
which you mentioned. Like five people died in that fire, and it was a much smaller blaze. It's amazing.
Again, this was not a residential area, so I think that helped in a sense.
Well, if it's one thing that we're lucky for, I mean, this could have been terribly catastrophic.
And you know, there were a certain number of residences in this district, and this is yet another thing that would push even those people, the remaining people downtown, to move uptown to more fashionable residential districts and get out of that commercial. Right. So as the area was rebuilt,
So now we're getting to really the long-lasting effects of what this fire is, and that's one of them. Like, this area from here on out really stopped being residential in any way. It's funny because now you go down there and there's all these new condos and things. It's almost like returning a little bit back to how it used to be. One of the things that was, of course, permanently changed by this was the water supply. I mean, that was the big problem, was getting water to fight this fire because of the freezing cold. And also, keep in mind that cholera epidemic that you had just mentioned. Between the two of these things, it was like New York has to improve its water supply. It just had to. So 2 years later began the construction of the Croton Aqueduct, which would bring water down from Westchester County and would distribute fresh water through a series of reservoirs into the city. Because of this tragedy, fire organizations improved and the equipment improved. A state-authorized fire department was actually organized in 1865 with the city version. So the birth of the New York Fire Department of New York City was in 1870. Mm-hmm. So things were steadily improving there. But I think most important was really the rebuilding efforts of this area. So a week after, and you're looking at the area, like, how can we possibly rebuild this? Well, keep in mind, you know, there's all of this money coming in from the Erie Canal. And, you know, New York is still building as a financial empire.
And some money came from the state. The federal government, I don't believe, gave any money to the rebuilding effort. And again, I mean, I almost get shivers when I'm even saying that. You know, there's so much happening, but let's just say it's such a poignant subject now, just thinking of rebuilding in this area, federal money, state money coming into it, and an area that does recover.
What's interesting is part of what made people move back to this area, like want to build their offices here again, was that the city had promised to widen the streets, because these were very, very narrow streets. They were very close together. It was part of the reason that the fire spread so quickly. So the city promised to widen the streets, and that actually made room for the opportunity to build really modern structures. Believe it or not, the price of the real estate in this area skyrocketed in the years following the Great Fire. These old Dutch structures that had been there for like a couple hundred years, they were all replaced with these brand new Greek revivalist structures, these big, mighty bank structures. Mm.
Some of which are still there today.
Yeah, many of them are. A great example, the street I had mentioned earlier, where you can kind of see the evidence of the Great Fire. Right. One of the most charming streets in the financial district, Stone Street, you know, it has those taverns and restaurants on it. It's a nice little street. Most of the buildings on that street were built in 1836. Mm-hmm. They were built the year after the fire, and most of them are still standing. And they were built sort of like with this in mind, that it was going to be less of a residential area and more of a place for just true commerce. Other buildings that were replaced with more elaborate structures were, for instance, Delmonico's original restaurant was destroyed in the fire. They rebuilt into this triangular building that's still down there today, right off of Beaver Street. A new merchant exchange building was built, and you know, all the riches that were gleaned from the Erie Canal profits were poured right into all these fantastic buildings. And of course, it became a home for banks and for all these financial institutions. You know, it's almost like it cleared away the past. It sort of knocked everything off the table and started over again. It sort of created a clean canvas for the new urban environment that would develop. And the shape of the financial district today is in part because of what happened here in the fire and how people reacted to it afterwards. More significantly, after this, there will be no more great fires. There will be no more fires that truly, like, wipe out swaths of blocks and endanger thousands of people's lives. There would, of course, be a lot of individual terrible disasters in the city. You know, things like the Brooklyn Theater fire in 1876. Of course, the Triangle factory fire. Of course, 9/11. Our city will never escape the sort of specter of fire and dangers of fire, but you will never have, after 1835, these kinds of fires that would threaten the existence of the entire city.
So thank you for joining us today as we look back to the Great Fire of 1835. I would like to give a special shout out to my friend Herbert Asbury.
Oh, of Gangs of New York fame?
Yes, who wrote an amazing piece where I got a lot of my information that appeared in the New Yorker magazine in 1930. And if you are a subscriber to the New Yorker magazine, you can search through their archives for, I believe, any article that has appeared. And the fun part is you can see it in its original format. These have been scanned in, so they're PDFs, and you see the original
ads along
with it. Yes, the month that this was appearing, the Pierre Hotel was about to open. And
wow.
Right. There are other fascinating, fascinating ads.
If we've ignited your interest in the Great Fire of 1835, please visit our blog, BoweryBoysPodcast.com, where I'll have a few pictures. There aren't a lot of pictures, understandably, from the fire of 1835, but there's lots of illustrations and paintings and everything. So thank you very much for listening. Have a great New York week, whether you live here or not.
See you real soon.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.